From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Governor Whitmer again catches criticism for violating her own COVID safety guidelines.
At the end of the day, she said that, you know, everyone was vaccinated, that she didn't stop to think about it, but that in retrospect, it was a mistake and that she's a human and that she apologizes for it.
Also, the state is sitting on a pile of cash for COVID recovery. What's the best way to invest that cash for students and schools?
Michigan schools will get something like $6 billion. That is, for folks who are maybe not following the school budget closely, a huge amount of money. It's the largest single investment in schools ever.
And Detroit neighborhoods, pandemic reckoning with air quality. When you're home all day, there's nowhere to hide from pollution. Can changes happen?
We're invisible, the majority of us around here. When I'm disabled, I'm on a fixed income. I'm invisible to them. I don't exist.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, how Michigan students might need to recover from the pandemic.
Talk to your school board, talk to your superintendent and school district staff, because they are going to have significant power to determine how a really large chunk of federal aid is spent.
That's coming up later in the hour. But first, this was a weekend in which a lot of people were out in public for the first time in a very long time. They included Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Whitmer was seen at Lansing's Landshark Bar and Grill hanging out with friends. There was just one problem, though. It was an awfully big group of friends. Governor Whitmer may have once again violated her own health agency's guidance. With us to talk about this and other state stories are Lauren Gibbons, policy and politics reporter at MLive. Hi, Lauren.
Hi.
Also with us today, Sergio Martinez Beltran. He's the Capitol reporter at Bridge, Michigan. Hi, Sergio. How you doing?
Hi, April. Thanks for having me.
So, Sergio, what do we know about the governor's big night out?
Well, I think it's important to go back to the reason why we're here. And that is because yesterday, the conservative news outlet Breitbart obtained a photo that showed Governor Whitmer at a local restaurant slash bar with 13 people at the table, including, by the way, Trisha Foster, who is the state's chief economic officer. And, you know, this is big because it seems like it's in violation of Governor Whitmer's MDHHS's policy. You know, on May 15th, the Department of Health and Human Services issued new policies and guidances on how many people can be seated at a table in a restaurant. And that rule says it's only 6 people per table and that no groups or of patrons can, you know, should be intermingling. And it seemed like in this case, the governor didn't follow that rule.
So as far as that state guidance, it's just so happens that today Governor Whitmer announced that that guidance was to be expanded. But just to be clear, it's okay today, but it wasn't okay when she was photographed doing this over the weekend, right?
I think it's not even okay today. I think it's okay on June 1st when the state will expand the capacity limit. So right now, that rule is still in effect and people need to only, and restaurants should only have 6 people per table.
Right. Sergio, what did the governor have to say today when she was having a press conference ostensibly about other matters? What does she have to say about the fact that she was dining inside maskless with such a big group?
You know, the governor apologized. She talked about how throughout the pandemic, she's been committed to following public health protocols. But she talked about how on Saturday, she was at this local restaurant with some friends, and that as more people arrived, the tables were pushed together. But at the end of the day, she said that, you know, everyone was vaccinated, that she didn't stop to think about it, but that in retrospect, it was a mistake and that she's a human and that she apologizes for it.
So if this were the only instance of an apparent double standard, I think that people might not be quite so exercised about it. But let us remember there have been some other instances when Governor Whitmer or her top staff have been out doing things that the governor's own health officials at a point when they were saying stay home. Sergio, can you remind us of what's been happening over the past couple months?
Right. I think the last 5 weeks, April, have been really tough on the governor because she has had to respond to a lot of controversies about herself or members of her staff violating state guidance. So, for example, you know, recently, Mirror's News reported on Governor Whitmer's travel to Florida to visit her father. That was in March 12th to the 15th. initially, her administration didn't disclose the travel, but then they said that it was 2 full days, and now we know the trip was 4 days. So the version has changed quite a bit. The big thing is the governor was not vaccinated when she went to travel to Florida. And, you know, the other big thing is that her administration was asking people to avoid traveling to the southern state because of the third wave of COVID-19. The other thing is that Trisha Foster, the woman that I talked about, who is the state's chief operating officer, she last month posted photos on social media of herself visiting Florida, despite Whitmer's warning against traveling. So the last 5 weeks, the governor has had to defend a lot of her staff and also her actions.
So let's talk about what this might mean for the upcoming gubernatorial race. Lauren Gibbons, do you think that this could open Gretchen Whitmer's flank any further to a post-Trump Michigan Republican Party?
You know, I think that a lot remains to be seen in terms of whether or not this has a long-term impact on the governor's reputation. I do think that right now, as people are still living under the restrictions, there's a lot of frustration. There's a reason that these sorts of stories are gaining so much traction. There's just a lot of people who are ready to be, you know, out and about again and seeing some of these restrictions lift. That said, it's a long time until 2022. We have a lot of names being circulated. There's still a chance that bigger names could get into a Republican primary race. So whether or not these frustrations over COVID-19 restrictions and some of the governor's actions that have already been referenced, you know, whether or not that sticks around in voters' minds as they start to think about whether they want to see her run the state for another 4 years, a lot could happen between now and that election.
Sergio, what's your take on this? Does the criticism hit any softer when it may be coming from opponents who have themselves been skeptical of health guidance through the course of the pandemic?
I think that's a great question. And what Republicans and many conservatives have said is that they were not the ones asking people to stay at home. They were not the ones asking people to avoid traveling. It was the governor. I do think, though, that Republicans are capitalizing on this incident. I mean, they're capitalizing on the governor's violation of the restaurant rules, but also they have been capitalizing on the traveling. You know, House Oversight Committee Chairman Steve Johnson, he sent Governor Gretchen Whitmer 43 questions regarding her trip, or he said his committee could launch an investigation. So I think for the next few weeks, we're going to continue seeing Republicans capitalizing on this.
Hey, let's talk about something else that was a pretty big news in Lansing late last week. Lauren, I know you've been following it. Michigan's receiving a historic surplus in the form of federal COVID relief funds. And I have to say this again, just because the number is so staggering, nearly $11 billion. That cash was locked up in a pretty rigid stalemate between the governor and legislative Republicans. What's going on with this money right now?
Yeah, you know, it seems as though there's some indication that the ongoing icy relations between the Republican-led legislature and Governor Gretchen Whitmer appears to have thawed somewhat. And that is largely because Republicans like what they're seeing in terms of some of these COVID-19 restrictions being lifted. At this point, they've announced that they are willing to, you know, have the governor's administration back into budget negotiations, whereas for the last several months, they've been kind of talking at each other as opposed to working together to try and find bipartisan ways to craft next year's budget and also figure out what to do with all of this extra money, both from the federal government and there's a projected surplus from state tax revenues. So moving forward, again, they've agreed to work together. We haven't seen what plans they've come up with or if they have any ideas on what a bipartisan way to get this money allocated might look like. So it could be a little bit before we see something get signed into law.
Lauren, do we know what changed? I mean, this was a really knockdown, drag-out dispute. Now the governor's saying she's willing to formalize the legislature's role in epidemic orders as part of this deal. What gave?
You know, I think a big part of that is honestly perhaps their thinking that there may not be that many pandemic orders left. The numbers are looking a lot better than they have. The vaccines are working. And while there is still some trepidation about whether or not Michigan can continue to keep the pace of vaccinations among those vaccine hesitant populations, overall, the numbers are looking a lot better than they have in a long time. And the trajectory is looking better for the state. So I think the administration is thinking, well, there's probably not going to be that many left. And then the legislature is thinking some of these restrictions that they have been opposing are now being lifted. So now at this point, you know, some of the arguments they've been making for holding up all of this additional money that's available to Michigan don't hold as much weight.
So I see that Detroit is planning a task force to decide how to allocate its share of the funds. There's going to be a lot of choices to make at cities all over. And then there's this money that the state can have discretion over itself. Last question, you guys. We have about a minute. What do you think? Are the dam roads finally going to get fixed? Sergio, you go first.
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, we'll see. They are going to start fighting over what projects should be funded. So it's going to be an interesting moment to watch.
Lauren, how about you? What do you think some of the big priorities will be for this?
I would say roads are definitely in the conversation. Although if you remember back in 2019, that was a pretty thorny topic that was very difficult for people to agree upon in a non-pandemic time. But this is a huge opportunity for one-time investments. And I assume that lawmakers, the administration, and budget officials are just looking at ways like, how can Michigan leverage this, you know, perhaps once in a generation opportunity is what I believe the budget director called it on Friday. And so there's going to be a lot of discussions, a lot of different interest groups looking at ways to, you know, maybe get additional funding through for their FET projects. But I think roads and schools are obviously going to be at the top of the pile. There's a lot of different opportunities and it's going to be a lot of factors at play.
Lauren Gibbons covers politics for MLive. We've also been talking with Sergio Martinez Beltran, Capitol reporter at Bridge, Michigan. Guys, it's great to hear from you. Hang in there.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
In a moment, what the pandemic has done to underscore the urgency of Detroit's air pollution problems.
Some of these projects are taking place in neighborhoods that are already experiencing a lot of pollution and a lot of heavy industry.
More after a break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The pandemic has shed some much-needed light on so many of the public health issues that were already in play before autumn 2019. In Detroit, chronic lung diseases like asthma and COPD are no exception. These are some of the conditions that are considered risk factors for a poor outcome if a person gets infected with COVID. With us today is Brian Allnut. He writes for Planet Detroit, and his most recent article looks at air pollution in the Motor City, asking the question, will COVID force us to take air pollution more seriously? Brian Allnut, welcome to Stateside.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about what kind of pollution we're talking about when we do talk about air pollution in Detroit?
So there's a number of pollutants that are impacting Detroiters, and that includes things like sulfur dioxide, volatile organic compounds, or VOCs, which can also contribute to the formation of ozone, and then PM2.5, or fine particulate matter, which... That last one comes from a variety of sources, including cars and trucks. And taken all together, these contribute to a high incidence of asthma and COPD, or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, when compared to the state average. And research shows that PM2.5 and ozone in particular are the primary driver for early mortality from air pollution in the city. And it's estimated that these two pollutants account for 660 premature deaths a year. Mm.
Brian, you went out with our Michigan radio colleague, Sarah Hewlett, and you two spoke with a man named Robert Shobe. He lives on the east side of Detroit in the Connor Creek neighborhood, right next door to the Stellantis Jefferson North Assembly Plant. And he talked to you about why he thinks they've been allowed to open and operate in spite of what Strobe sees as obvious public health risks. Let's take a listen.
Because it's majority black owned and because of income. We're invisible to majority of us around here. When I'm disabled, I'm on a fixed income, I'm invisible to them. I don't exist.
So this is unfortunately not a very new story. Communities most affected by pollution from industrial companies like this are mostly low income, and a majority are people of color. And these also happen to be some of the same communities that are experiencing disproportionately high infection of COVID. What do we know about COVID outcomes in places like this where pollution is high?
So there was a Harvard study that came out this past year that showed places where there's historically been a lot of air pollution over a long period of time, and they were specifically looking at PM2.5, that was associated with an 11% increase in COVID mortality. Although experts that I spoke with stressed that causation hasn't been definitively proved there. It's also been suggested that the virus itself could attached to this particulate matter and spread more easily. And that's been backed up by a few studies that have come out.
Yeah.
But in Detroit, experts say that pollution could be causing worse outcomes, but that the pollution often exists in neighborhoods where there's also a lot of poverty. There's a history of discrimination and poor access to healthcare, and all of those are contributing as well, along with social factors like in-person work, working in factories and warehouses that can make it more easy for the virus to spread, as well as multi-generational household, public transit use, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Recent data from the city show that there's very high case rates in zip codes in Southwest Detroit that have historically had a lot of pollution. And so that would include the 48210 zip code, which has the highest rate of confirmed cases in the city, and the 48209 zip code, which is in the top three. Although there are other places that have high case rates and high mortality that aren't necessarily the most polluted areas.
Mm-hmm. Brian, you were looking at a couple of neighborhoods that have big projects. Renovations or big builds going on that included something called the Community Benefits Agreement. For folks who may not know that term, can you explain what those are?
Yeah, so a Community Benefits Agreement is a contract between a developer and a community to deliver certain benefits to the place where that project is taking place. And oftentimes that looks like building parks or providing a certain amount of jobs. And Detroit has a community benefits ordinance now that requires developers to offer benefits if a project is a certain size or if it receives a certain amount of public investment. So the Gordie Howe Bridge project in the Delray neighborhood in Southwest and the Fiat Chrysler or Stellantis expansion on the east side are examples of this, although only the latter as part of the official community benefits ordinance. And some of these projects are taking place in neighborhoods that are already experiencing a lot of pollution and a lot of heavy industry. Delray and Southwest in particular has a number of industries, or is close to a number of industries, including Marathon and AK Steel. And also, there are several expressways and a lot of truck traffic.
It sounds like there's some potential here to use these community benefit agreements to mitigate pollution. How much is that happening?
Advocates say not as much as it should. On the east side, the FCA Stellantis expansion, which is a big project encompassing several auto facilities, it received tax incentives that could total more than $400 million, and it's expected to create several thousand jobs. But it's also expected to increase emissions for VOCs, which, as I mentioned before, they can combine with nitrogen oxides to create ozone. And that's a major trigger for asthma. So $15,000 is being offered per house in the area near the plant. And that's to help people do things like install new windows that could help protect them from pollution. But some residents have said that that money isn't even enough to repair damage that was caused to foundations and windows by the project itself. I spoke with Robert Shobe, who lives right next door to the plant, and he has COPD, he's had cancer, and he said that the community benefits that the city negotiated for him and his neighbors is wholly inadequate.
A real community benefits would have started with the studies going down before they ever moved a piece of dirt or concrete or built anything. They would have studied what the impact would have been on the community and had some kind of resolution or done something to mitigate what they were going to do here instead of just, well, we're going to get jobs and that's what it's all about and we're not going to let these jobs get away. So whatever it takes, we're going to push this through. And that's what happened. They pushed it through.
Yeah. So, Brian, what is an alternative? Would something like relocating be an option for somebody like Mr. Shobe?
It does not seem to be an option as part of the present community benefits agreement, but that is what Mr. Shobe is looking for. But he says that for some of his neighbors, that's not even an option.
My neighbor over there is 94 years old. She's been living over there 55, 60 years. She's not looking to go anywhere. She should be able to be safe in her home if nothing else. She doesn't get out and go a lot anyway. So why not come over here and do what needs to be done to make her house safe from these pollutants that potentially are coming out? We know they're coming out, but on what level? Who knows?
So the message I'm getting here is that it hasn't been a very effective method so far, but that the agreements could be vehicles for more pollution mitigation. What about the neighborhoods where there are not new projects to attach these requirements to?
Well, there's certainly things that could be done, and that could be something as simple as vegetative buffering or tree planting along major roadways to catch pollution. Also, more monitoring and stricter enforcement for companies that are violating pollution limits. That could have a deterrent effect across the city. And many advocates are pushing for permitting that looks at cumulative impacts from various industries in a community rather than examining each permit on a case-by-case basis. Also, an environmental justice screening tool like the one that California uses could help, and that directs investment in pollution reductions to communities that have been impacted by environmental injustice.
I know that you were interested in finding out if President Biden's COVID relief packages might include something that would help people out. What were you able to find out about that?
Well, I don't know, and I'm not sure if local governments know how they're going to spend that money yet or not, but that's definitely something that community advocates are pushing for. They believe that some of this money should be used to fund home repairs, which is a major issue in the city of Detroit, and something that could help protect Detroiters from a number of environmental threats, not just air pollution, but you know, issues like heat and flooding as well.
Brian Allnut is a writer whose work appears at planetdetroit.org. You can see his latest article about air pollution and public health right now on the website. Brian, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
The shoreline along the St. Mary's River in the eastern Upper Peninsula is getting washed away, eroding lawns and flooding septic systems. And that's not just because of high water levels. Large freighters cruise up and down the river, and if they go fast enough, a surge of water follows. Residents are desperate for relief.
I just want them to go slow. I mean, it's physics. Lighten your load, lessen the speed. We can't do anything about the water level.
Interlochen Public Radio's Lexi Krupp visited a town along the river this spring. She filed this report.
About 20 people turned out for the April town hall meeting in Bruce Township. That might not sound like a lot, but it's a big crowd for the small community in the UP. It's a lot of older people. Everyone knows each other.
Hey, Paula.
Hi, dear.
How are you? Good. How are you doing?
There was a proposal to reduce the speed limit along a residential stretch of road. Then the latest report from the fire department. Just one fire. Someone cooking sap in their garage. But the reason most people were here was because of erosion along the shoreline and boat speeds. Bruce Township sits along a narrow stretch of the St. Mary's River. It's the artery that connects the waters of Lake Superior down to the rest of the Great Lakes. Water levels reached record highs last summer.
We all know that this is a natural disaster. It's no different than a tornado or a hurricane in the high waters.
Chris Clark is a retired nurse whose family has lived on the river for generations. She says water levels have always cycled up and down. What's different now is commercial shipping. Boats are bigger and heavier. They displace a lot of water and can be a real threat to people's homes.
And we all choose to live on the river and we can't do anything about the high waters, but we do something about the speed of the boats. I hope, but I don't know where to turn. And you can see by the turnout tonight, we're all very concerned about this.
The county where the township sits, Chippewa County, has one of the highest flooding risks in Michigan. Nearly one in five homes is susceptible to flood damage. In some stretches along the St. Mary's River, almost every homeowner has had problems. Like Pat Lightfoot. He lost his long wooden dock last year.
That water was so high, and that boat freighter came by, and we had to spend $15,000 on a roll dock because I just took all the sections that floated in and gave them away because I was done. For all those years, it was...
Pat showed me his property in Barbo on a misty morning the next day.
Down here is always moist.
He lives in a ranch with a wooden deck off the back facing the river. For the last two summers, his yard has been completely underwater.
Yeah, at the height of it, the water was, you step off a step, you were in the water.
And it's still really,
Yeah, you see the leaf line? That's where the water was.
Pat says just about all his neighbors' yards have caved in, and he knows their properties well because he mows their lawns every summer. The high waters meant he's had less mowing to do.
Oh, yeah. I made out like a bandit last year.
But the swamped yards have caused all sorts of problems, like flooded septic systems. Whenever his neighbors flush their toilet, the water just gurgles. And things might be better this year. So far, it's been dry. Water levels on the river are way down.
Oh, if it stayed like this, they'd be fine. But getting it to stay like this, I don't know who has a good word with the man upstairs, but I don't know if any of us do.
To protect their homes over the past few years, people on the river have been building breakwalls or fortifying the shoreline with chunks of concrete or boulders. To do that, you need several permits and money. And not everyone can afford these protections. At the town hall meeting, one homeowner said he was quoted $30,000 to $40,000 to install a breakwall. He didn't have the money. So some residents are asking for help.
The issue is the speed limits have to come down, and there needs to be something to help us put our property back together.
This is Chris Clark again, the retired nurse who lives in a tidy house on the river. She's gone to township meetings across the region and contacted local politicians and her representatives in Congress. So far, though, nothing's happened.
Everybody agrees that it's terrible, and then it just dies. And, you know, you just feel a little impotent when you don't get anywhere.
Repairing septic systems or building seawalls isn't covered under flood insurance. And as for the boat speed, it turns out local and state governments can't do anything about commercial shipping. That's regulated by the U.S. Coast Guard.
Enforcement, Lieutenant Nanny speaking. How can I help you?
Lieutenant Barton Nanny works in Sault Ste. Marie. He says lowering the speed limit on the St. Mary's River isn't something the Coast Guard is considering right now.
While I wouldn't say it's impossible, it does depend on many different factors.
According to Barton, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers would need to step in and deem existing speed limits unsafe. Meanwhile, he says if homeowners do think commercial boats are speeding, they should give the Coast Guard a call. But residents like Chris Clark and Pat Lightfoot have called the Coast Guard a lot.
Every time I call them, they tell me there's nothing we can do.
The problem isn't speeding, Pat says. It's the speed limit. And the solution seems obvious. So far, though, it doesn't seem like anyone is listening. I'm Lexi Krupp.
This story first appeared on the Interlochen Public Radio podcast Points North. If you'd like more news from up north, you can look for it wherever you listen to podcasts. While you're at it, please do check out the Daily Stateside podcast. It's a fresh take on conversations that you may have heard on the show, sometimes a little bit extended. Michigan's most essential conversations every day on the Stateside podcast. How should schools plan a recovery from the pandemic year?
We don't want to just jump right back in to the academics and try to fit everything back in to the existing time frame. We need to prioritize, we need to focus, but the first thing we need to do is make sure that our kids are feeling comfortable, safe. We need to look at it from a whole child approach.
We've got some thoughts on that right after the break. Back in a moment. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan students have really been through the ringer this year. Online classes, canceled events, isolation from their friends and school support. It appears likely that by this fall, school will be back to looking something closer to normal. So how should we help students adjust after everything that they've been through in the past year? A state advisory council has just released a report outlining recommendations on how to do that. With us today is Kevin Paulston, chair of the Student Recovery Advisory Council. He's also the outgoing superintendent at Godfrey Lee Schools just outside of Grand Rapids. And he's taking a new job. He's the incoming superintendent of Kentwood Public Schools. Kevin Paulston, welcome to Stateside.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start out by talking a little bit about what the past year has been like for students in your district. Can you give us the thumbnail sketch?
Well, I've been really pleased at the efforts of our students and staff. We've had an in-person option since the first day of school for our families that chose it. We've had a virtual option for those that wanted it as well. And just due to the close proximity to COVID that this community's had, 50% of our families chose virtual, but for those 50% that chose in person for our elementary, they've been in person since day one without, you know, any pauses for the whole building. We've certainly dealt with quarantines and all the other mitigation strategies necessary. But I've been incredibly proud of the efforts, incredibly proud of our staff as well for, you know, really making this opportunity happen for our kids. Without question, the in-person opportunity is better for those that want it. And we have a lot of data that supports that. So dealing with all the masks and distancing and sanitization, hand washing, all that has been a challenge, but we've managed and I'm really pleased with where we're at.
Kevin, I know that you have experience in a district with a high percentage of English language learners. Could you talk about what kind of support those families will need as their kids return to the classroom and maybe what unique challenges they were facing when it came to the pandemic year?
One of the things that we found is we have to get closer to our families, and remote learning certainly highlighted that need for us to make sure that we're not asking our families to wrap around school, that school is wrapping around our families. So we've hired some positions that technology help desk for our families that has a bilingual operator to help support our families. We've hired virtual success coaches that will support our families with virtual learning. We see some of those positions, you know, evolving to supporting English learners, but more so supporting families of English learners in ways that they can understand and support their children.
One of the big emphases within the plan is trying to address some of the mental health challenges that the kids have been dealing with. What does that look like?
Well, we are in the relationships business, and so we want to make sure that we start with the wellness of our children when we return. That's their mental health, social-emotional health, as well as their physical health. And so you'll see things, you know, like conduct a screener when kids come back just to see where they're at with their wellness, in particular their mental wellness, because we know kids can't learn until they feel socially, emotionally safe and their mental health needs are being tended to. We don't want to just jump right back in to the academics and try to fit everything back in to the existing time frame. We need to prioritize, we need to focus, but the first thing we need to do is make sure that our kids are feeling comfortable, safe, and again, we need to look at it from a whole child approach.
Another point of focus in the report is the mental health of school staffers, including the issue of burnout. I don't know if anyone has had a chance to overhear a teacher leading a hybrid classroom with some kids in person and at the same time other kids attending via Zoom, but it is intense. And that's to say nothing of the challenges that teachers have been going through in an all-online environment when that was necessary. How can districts give their staff support?
Well, without question, our teachers have been essential workers and have been just critical to the well-being of our students and in keeping things moving throughout the pandemic. We've partnered in the blueprint. You'll see partnerships from districts such as Wyoming Public Schools that has a partnership with Pine Rest Mental Health Services, so that any one of their staff can get the support they need, or partnering with MESA, which is a healthcare provider that many districts utilize. They have a whole wellness support system in districts that can serve as exemplars for that. We know that in order for our kids to learn at high levels, our teachers have to be, you know, feeling the same way we just describe our students. They got to be feeling, you know, whole as well. And so districts need to acknowledge that while there may be some new strategies that we're going to incorporate this fall that require professional learning and that require time, we have to understand that our teachers have also been enduring this pandemic professionally, but also personally. It's touched lives in very different ways. And so it's vital that we provide supports necessary for our staff, that when they come back in the fall, that they're ready to greet their students and get going. And that means they have to have support resources as well.
Kevin Polston is chair of Michigan's Student Recovery Advisory Council. He is also the incoming super at Kentwood Public Schools. Kevin, thank you for your time.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So what might fund all those things that students and schools need to get beyond the losses of this year? For once, that question comes with a pretty clear answer. With us to talk about the bigger picture is Kobe Levin, reporter for Chalkbeat Detroit. Kobe, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me.
So these recommendations that the council is putting forward, how do they compare with what you've been hearing from teachers and students and their families and administrators all through the past year?
You know, it's been a huge struggle for everybody. It's pretty easy, I think, given just how widespread these challenges have been, to write down on a report that teachers don't feel like they're succeeding and connecting with students the way that they normally do, that students have been thrown for a loop, that parents are struggling. It's, I think, much more difficult to actually begin to address those problems. I mean, we've been getting into this mess for more than a year, thanks to the coronavirus. And it will take at least that long to begin to make things better. The good news, though, is that the state and its schools are going to receive a really significant amount of federal funding to help make some of these improvements and supports available for folks.
Yeah, like you mentioned, Kobe, this is a pretty unusual time. Schools actually have a big chunk of change to spend. The American Recovery Act from the federal government included $125 billion for K-12 education nationwide. Can you talk about what Michigan's piece of that pie is and how the report suggests investing that money?
Sure. So in total, in addition to the American Recovery Act, which came through the Biden administration, plus money that came through during the last year of the Trump administration, Michigan schools will get something like $6 billion. That is, for folks who are maybe not following the school budget closely, a huge amount of money. It's the largest single investment in schools ever. And especially because school budgets haven't been cut sharply during the pandemic, as many feared they would, it represents an opportunity for schools to begin doing things that they just weren't doing before, that they didn't have the resources to do. Of course, those additional maybe staff people, those additional resources and materials for students are especially badly needed now. I'll get into some of the specifics that this report talks about, because it does say explicitly that schools should consider investing the money that they're going to get from the federal government in things like high dosage tutoring. So that's putting an adult, maybe even one-on-one with the students who've fallen furthest behind,
Wow.
which is expensive. There's a lot of evidence to show that one-on-one tutoring is really effective. It works for students, but it's not easy to get down to that kind of adult to student ratio. Districts, though, will have some money to do that. They'll also have the funds to increase the numbers of counselors, social workers, school psychologists, and nurses. That's another key recommendation from this panel. You know, we've had ratios of those kinds of support staff well below the recommended amount. And yet, any teacher will tell you that students have a wide range of needs that can't be addressed by one person at the front of the classroom. Students come in with health needs. They have mental health needs. Their families may need to be connected with social services. And without adults in school buildings who can address those problems, teachers end up having to bear the brunt of it. And that comes at a cost for student learning. So this is an opportunity for schools to up staff in the according to this this panel that was appointed by Governor Gretchen Whitmer.
So to the extent that some of Michigan's schools are already spending the money, Kobe, how much do you see their spending patterns lining up with what the report is suggesting we do?
I think it's a little bit too early to say. Schools have just begun to submit plans for this kind of spending. June is the month where most districts will set their budgets for the coming school year. And so that will be a key decision point. They have begun to spend some of the federal funds on things like improvements to their ventilation systems, on personal protective equipment, and other COVID mitigation strategies. But in terms of the recovery, I think that remains to be seen. But definitely, I mean, if you're thinking about this, there's no better way to get a deeper look at what's happening in your own community than to go to your school board meeting. Talk to your school board, talk to your superintendent and school district staff, because they are going to have significant power to determine how a really large chunk of federal aid is spent.
So the push for infrastructure spending in Michigan schools with this explosion of federal money, can you tell us a little bit more about the need for that?
Sure. So Michigan is one of a handful of states in the U.S. that does not provide direct funding from state coffers to school infrastructure. So that means repairs to school buildings, new gyms, you know, all the stuff that communities like to have. The way that communities make up for that is by taxing themselves. Through local taxes, they make renovations, make improvements. They get the facilities that they want. The trouble is that not all communities can afford the same level of taxes, and not all communities have the property values that allow them to raise enough money to really invest in their schools. So if we look across the state, there's a huge level of inequity. Wealthier communities have nicer schools. Communities with lower incomes have schools that are often falling apart, that badly need investment. Now, the federal aid is going to go proportionately more to our communities with high levels of child poverty. And that could help some of those schools make improvements that they've been putting off for a really long time.
Yeah. And the depth of the need, I mean, when you think about schools that you've visited, I mean, what kinds of infrastructure issues are we talking about? Something like a new boiler for a building or an entirely new building? I mean, what's the depth of what districts are considering or might consider?
So let's see, the superintendent in Hamtramck, who I spoke with about this, said that they were going to be able to go ahead and both make really significant renovations and even build some new facilities for students who were in portable classrooms.
Oh, wow.
And in Detroit, I mean, there's been a really significant pending bill. A few years ago, it was $500 billion for improvements. It may have gone up somewhat since then. And they're going to be able to make a pretty significant dent in those needed repairs to basic functions, you know, things like building plumbing, boilers, like you mentioned, and maybe even constructing some new schools where schools have gone completely out of date.
So not all of the plans that school districts are submitting or are talking about submitting are things that they can do by themselves. And I understand that some of them would require some help from the state legislature. Can you walk us through that?
Right. Well, one of the basic things is that a lot of families are still saying that they'd like their students to learn virtually in the fall. This may be, because families have particular health needs. It may be just because they're particularly cautious about the coronavirus. One way or another, though, they don't have permission. Districts do not have permission at this point from the state legislature to do that. They were given special permission last year, but it's still somewhat controversial, especially on the Republican side. Folks are really pushing against virtual instruction. So it remains to be seen whether districts will be allowed to offer a virtual instruction option for families that want it.
Kobe, $6 billion is a lot of money. Do you see the federal cash being transformative over the long term, or maybe more as a bridge back to the old normal?
It depends. It depends on whether it's spent effectively, of course. It also depends on whether school districts are able to find, investments that will really last. Now, you'll hear a lot of superintendents, school business officials say that in fact, the infrastructure approach, that paying for improvements to buildings is a great way to do that. You pay for a building now that lasts 30 years, especially in communities where the school facilities are crumbling. That's a really good thing to do. I mean, students need high quality school buildings in order to learn. At the same time, it would be transformational if the state used this funding to help students get back on their feet, to help them recover from this incredibly difficult year. I mean, the coronavirus and the chaos that it's caused has been transformational in a bad way. It's really put the hurt on folks. And if this funding is used effectively, if it's used in a targeted way to help the students who've been who've lost the most this year, to get back into it, to catch up, that is a form of transformation back to the path that we want to be on, with all students getting the education and the support that they need.
One last thing I've got to ask. Anyone who's watched a kid try to deal with distance learning and being removed from their friends and stuck with their family all day knows what a lift this has been. At the same time, anyone who's overheard a distance learning class, or even more so, a teacher who's working with both distance learners and kids in person at the same time, can tell you that this is not typical. Have you heard of any schools addressing the psychological factors and the burnout that both students and teachers and administrators are dealing with?
I'm really glad you raised the experience of teachers in particular. I mean, no doubt for students, especially our younger students, Zoom classrooms are far from ideal, but it's also not what teachers signed up for. Teachers are in this to support students, to help kids learn. And it's really hard to do that over Zoom. We've seen poll numbers indicating that teachers' sense of their own success with students is plummeting. That's typically correlated with teacher turnover, teacher burnout, with folks leaving the profession. That's something we can't afford in Michigan. Turnover and other problems in the teacher pipeline were already really significant barriers to our success as a state in education. This is actually mentioned in the council's report. They call for new financial incentives to attract teachers to the profession and keep them there, things like loan forgiveness and scholarships, as a way of saying that the work that they do is valued and that the state really wants and needs to keep teachers in the classroom over the next couple of years as they work to bring students back to where they need to be.
Kobe Levin is a reporter with Chalkbeat Detroit. You can read his latest story on how schools might recover from the pandemic online. Kobe, it's a real pleasure hearing your voice again. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.